You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There's been a lot of discussion during the current election cycle about what role religion should play in politics, but it's nothing new. Remember the emergence of Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell as political figures many decades ago. In his new book, God's Right Hand, How Jerry Falwell Made God a Republican and Baptized the American Right, Michael Sean Winters talks about Jerry Falwell's life and its impact on American politics today. The book is published by Harper One, and it brings Mr. Winters to our show. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
I was surprised to learn that Falwell's parents were agnostics.
His mother was devout, but his father was quite aggressively agnostic and had no family history of religious devotion.
He was also a criminal.
Yes, there was that, who murdered his own brother or shot him in self-defense.
So was he that just an odd situation? Didn't he have a reputation for being a rather dangerous guy?
They were pretty wild. He was a bootlegger. He also had some legitimate businesses. He was quite successful. They were affluent. He ran some of the first bus lines in Virginia. He had a series of restaurants and gas stations around town and a gas distribution business. So he's quite successful, but he also had some shady operations on the side.
And he liked to play tricks on people, including Jerry's childhood friends.
He did. Jerry recalls that when he was a young boy, he brought this friend who was already scared of his father to visit, and they walked into the room, and the father took out a gun and shot at the boy's feet and then said, "I've been trying to kill that fly all day." And of course, the kid went screaming from the house.
But Jerry also became quite a prankster at school, even toward the teacher. He could be kind of mean. He terrorized the phys ed teacher.
He did. And it's curious that even many years later, his description of it was, you know, that this guy was very effeminate and was always giving them a hard time. And so
that was justified.
Well, I mean, that was his justification, which is strange. I mean, you can see, you know, kids do pranks. We understand that. But 40, 50 years later, to try to justify it.
So did he express admiration for his father, or was he embarrassed by his shady past?
It's, you know, it's hard to know. He always, you know, his father, he would claim that his father came to Jesus before he died in the last few weeks. He would talk openly about his father's severe alcoholism and things like that. But he would always work it into this narrative of conversion, which is it all worked out at the end because he came to Jesus.
Well, the same is true for Jerry, who was actually the leader of a gang in high school, which would suggest that he had a knack for leading people. Did he ever get punished for any of his pranks?
The only punishment he got, which he, again, many years later, still you could sense the resentment, was he was the valedictorian of his class, but he was not allowed to give the valedictorian speech at his commencement address because he and some of his football buddies had found a way to steal the coupons for hot lunch at the school. And so he was punished for that by being denied the right to speak at graduation.
And he resented the fact that he'd been punished?
Yeah.
Did he have no notion of sin when he was a kid?
At that point, he was unconverted. I mean, it was only in college when he came to Jesus.
Well, if he were here, how would he tell his conversion story?
You know, it's a very typical motif where there's a suddenness. He just one day decides to go, is told that this church, the Park Avenue Church, has some pretty girls. And so he gets some boys to go, and they sit down, and, you know, he hears the word, and a deacon comes up and says, "Would you like to go to the altar, son?" and says the conversion prayer to him, and he goes to the altar and never really looked back.
And this was Baptist church?
Yes, it was a Baptist church.
Not Southern Baptist. Pat Robertson was Southern Baptist, and there is a difference.
Pat Robertson was actually a charismatic, which is even
more
different.
But he's a charismatic Southern Baptist.
Right.
It's a very
strange. It's very strange. This was an independent Baptist church, and that was what Falwell was most of his life, this group that is separated from the Southern Baptists.
And Jerry Falwell wanted to make it clear that he wasn't a charismatic, that he didn't speak in tongues.
He was a very traditional Baptist, a
fundamentalist. But the words evangelical and fundamentalist get linked here, although aren't they pretty much the same thing?
Well, I think they're, you know, evangelical just means, you know, obviously rooted in the Gospels in some sense, which is kind of curious because Protestants tend not to actually be rooted in the Gospels, much more focused on the Hebrew Scriptures and on the Pauline epistles than on the Gospel stories. But it is that, it is evangelical, a catch-all phrase that tends to include Pentecost Pentecostals, Charismatics, and fundamentalists.
And they believe in the inerrancy of the Bible.
That is, I think what distinguishes fundamentalists is their sense of biblical inerrancy and other key doctrines of the church.
So when he was converted, did his reckless behavior change?
Sort of. There was one incident. He goes to the seminary in Missouri. And he already was attracted to this woman who would become his wife. And his roommate was her betrothed. And he would offer to go to the mail and say, you know, do you have any letters? And if the letters were to Maisel, he would throw them away and send his own love letters. And which is, you know, pretty outrageous invasion of privacy. And this is after his conversion. But it worked, and evidently Maisel had not taken their engagement very seriously, and he sort of knew that, and he ended up marrying her.
What did his old friends in the Wall Street, the Wall Gang, it wasn't the Wall Street, the right. Wall Gang, how did they react to this conversion?
Some of them joined him and became lifelong friends. Others did not. But he left quite soon thereafter. His conversion was in January, and he... by that fall was at seminary in Missouri.
Was Maisel a pious person? How did she feel about being pursued by the resident bad boy?
She played the piano at the church he attended, and her family was very, very religious, and her parents were quite suspicious of any Falwell because, of course, they were familiar with the name. Lynchburg is a small enough city where everyone knew everyone. But they were brought around by the sincerity of his conversion.
My guest is Michael Sean Winters. His book, God's Right Hand, How Jerry Falwell Made God a Republican and Baptized the American Right. You say that from the start his interest was in conversion, converting other people, proselytizing based on what he heard with the radio preachers?
He had grown up hearing the radio preachers. His mother would play them, and Charles Fuller was her favorite and became his favorite. And so one of the reasons he chose this church was he was told that they had that kind of fire and brimstone preaching, Park Avenue. And yes, once he converted and went to seminary and came back, he wasn't sure where he was going to land as a pastor. But he immediately, as soon as he did, actually Maisel's family was part of a group that, while he was away, separated and wanted to start their own church. They asked him to be the pastor. And he immediately started door knocking, trying to do 100 doors a day to bring people to his church.
But even before, he obviously was a born salesman. He enticed young boys to come to Bible study.
Yes, absolutely. He had a real gift for a kind of entrepreneurial approach to evangelization.
And he also tried to recruit patients while they were in the hospital?
That story actually was not him, but he would send out lay deputies to go out and knock on doors with him. And there was a report that some of them would go to the hospital and go to patients who were, you know, near death and really, you know, put the fear of God into them. And the staff at the hospital understandably got quite upset, as did other ministers.
He took detailed notes about every person he encountered during his door-knocking campaigns. What information was most useful to him?
Did they have a radio? Did they attend a different church? Was there anyone who was sick in the family? Any children of Sunday school age and things like that. He started renting buses so that they could go around on Sunday morning and pick students up to bring them, which was, you know, a great convenience. And so he would take whatever he thought would help on the follow-up, and the follow-up would always be a handwritten letter by the end of the week and a copy of the parish newspaper.
Do we have any sense of his politics at this time?
He was at this point... He would say later that he was, you know, pretty much always a Republican and certainly liked Eisenhower and voted for Eisenhower. But as a pastor, he kept them quite separate. And he still believed in the Baptist doctrine of the spirituality of the church, that moral reformation in this life was not the task of the church. The task of the church was to preach the saving grace of Jesus Christ, and that the two were quite in conflict. Part of fundamentalism's founding at the beginning part of the 20th century was in response to the social gospel movement, and which had tried to say Christian charity is not enough. We need to actually, you know, create social structures that will aid the poor.
But also were more open to the sciences and other things that
Absolutely.
Were happening. Fundamentalism rejects all of that.
Absolutely.
Now, how did he get into broadcasting? Was it radio at first?
It was radio at first, and he, again, in these door knockings, he noticed that a lot of people at home had the radio on. And he said this would be a good idea. And so he went to the local radio station, and they gave him a half hour every morning with the sunrise. The station back then would start with the sunrise, so the time varied in the course of the year. But the first half hour was Jerry saying which neighborhoods he would be visiting in the course of the day, giving a very short sermon, a short reading from the scripture. And this kind of chatty talk about the news of his church. And it was evidently very, very effective. And a few years later, he went to the new TV station and did the same.
And he even had his church set up like a TV studio.
When not at first. The first church was an old Donald Duck bottling company, a soda manufacturing company. And then in 1964, he built a larger sanctuary next to that. That did not have any special arrangements for church. At that time, he was still going to the local studio. But then in 1970, his church had grown so much they had to build a still larger adjacent structure, which held 4,000 people, and that was set up to televise all of his services.
He was also selling other things like Bibles.
Oh, and so the Jesus lapel pens, Jesus' first lapel pens. I mean, that, you know, there's a joke that the Falwell and Billy Graham and Oral Roberts are on a plane, and it's going down. And, of course, Oral Roberts tries to lay hands on the plane, and that doesn't work. And Billy Graham says, you know, Jesus, just love Jesus and you'll be saved. And Jerry Falwell says, this is the absolute last chance to buy a large print Bible. You
know? He became very wealthy as a result, all tax-free.
It's hard to get through all of the things because, of course, like the church bought his house that he lived in, and that was the rectory. And that still belongs to the church. So he was not personally wealthy, but certainly he was well provided for by his church.
And at this point, he hasn't gone national, has he?
That starts in the late 60s where his old-time gospel hour, which was his Sunday morning service, starts getting picked up first in other media areas of Virginia, in Roanoke and Charlottesville, and then it starts going national in the early 70s.
Around the same time that Pat Robertson and Jim Baker were going national?
Exactly.
How did his show compare to the other televangelists and somebody today like T.D. Jakes?
His style, I mean, they would just basically televise the morning service at that point. So it was much more formal than, say, the Bakers, who had this kind of, you know, chat show. And he only had that hour of television, whereas some of the other empires had their own networks. And so there were talk shows, there were church services, there were a variety of things. But his style was always quite formal. He never left the pulpit. His son, who's the pastor now, it's now a fourth sanctuary, which is still larger. And he walks up and down the stage and has a little mobile microphone, you know, under his chin and things like that. This was not Jerry's style.
In 1965, Jerry delivered his ministers and marchers sermon, one of his most famous ever. What was that about?
He condemned Dr. King and other religious ministers for being involved in politics. Now, at this time, he still defended segregation. But the real focus of the sermon was not so much a biblical defense of segregation as it was a biblical challenge to ministers being overly involved in politics, which is obviously quite ironic given his subsequent career. But he was so fond of that, and it created such a stir that he had that sermon printed in pamphlet form and distributed.
So did he ever address that irony?
Eventually. He just said, I got it wrong. I was reading the scriptures wrong. Now, you wish, in retrospect, that that had occasioned him to question the way he approached the scriptures. But alas, it did not. He just said, oh, I was reading it wrong.
When we come back, we'll find out what got him into politics. We'll take a little break here. My guest is Michael Sean Winters, who's written for publications including The New Republic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, Washingtonian, Slate.com, and America. He is a journalist for National Catholic Reporter, and his latest book is God's Right Hand, How Jerry Falwell Made God a Republican and Baptized the American Right. It is published by Harper One. We're back with Michael Sean Winters, who has been writing about politics for The New Republic. In fact, recently wrote an article about Jerry Falwell. in conjunction with his new book called God's Right Hand, How Jerry Falwell Made God a Republican and Baptized the American Right. It's published by Harper One. Did Jerry Falwell make God a Republican all by himself?
There was a clear groundswell. There was a key moment. He was very reluctant to get overtly involved in politics.
Because Pat Robertson's father was a senator, so there was a natural connection there.
Although, remember, the Robertsons were patrician. You know, Robertson went to Yale. It's a very different kind of sociocultural dynamic. You know, if you go to Lynchburg, it's not Yale. But he was very reluctant to get involved. He thought the people in the pews would resent it. And one of the things that convinced him was some of the Republican operatives who were trying to convince him to get involved did a poll. And they found out that the people in the pews were actually chomping at the bit to get politically involved.
So the fundamentalist community was not as committed to separation of church and state as he had been until then.
Exactly.
So was everybody in his group receptive to his getting involved? And it started with the moral majority, didn't it?
There were some people who thought this was a bad idea, both for him personally and also stuck to the traditional doctrine of the spirituality of the church and thought that it was not the place of ministers to be so involved. But he did get overwhelming support. What he was able to bring uniquely to the Republican Party was, of course, he had, by 1979, when the moral majority was established, was this vast network of pastors and preachers throughout the country, and their flocks really were not registered or educated.
But you say one of his aides, Ed Dobson, felt that Falwell hadn't thought it through completely and didn't understand all the implications of what he was doing.
And that they were very much better evangelicals at being against things than ever figuring out a kind of positive political platform. I mean, this is part of the evangelical tradition, is the Jeremy ad, the confrontation with the culture, the denouncing of sin and all that. That's part of their tradition. But sitting down, they have no corollary like you'd find in the Catholic Church of the natural law teaching tradition and a social justice tradition and encyclicals over hundreds of years kind of approaching these issues.
You say that by creating the moral majority, Falwell was actually aiding the very secularization that he was fighting to defeat. Did he ever realize the effect that his work was having on Christian culture?
No. Not only did he not do it, but it was curious. There were plenty of criticisms of Jerry Falwell during his lifetime. And no one ever pointed out that by reducing religion to ethics, he was in fact leaving the doctrine at the door when he entered the public square, which was the very thing he tried to oppose at the beginning.
Someone I know actually debated some issue with Jerry Falwell on television. And during the break, he said it became clear that what Jerry Falwell really wanted to do was win. It didn't matter what, you know. And he said, we're going to get you guys. Were all of the political positions held by that he proposed held by members of the moral majority? Anti-abortion, resistance to gay rights, cutting taxes, and were they— did they find justification for them in Scripture?
He did. I mean, this is, you know, he would point to the book of Proverbs and say quite clearly, you know, the book of Proverbs, you know, says that the free enterprise system is God's way of approaching economic issues.
Where is that in the book of Proverbs?
He would cite it very vaguely, but the all of his positions, he would find some kind of biblical basis for, but this is kind of the problem I most have with his approach, which is he would find the political issue and then go in search of the justification rather than taking the Bible as a whole and saying, you know, where are the consistent themes and ethics coming from here?
How is he adjusting to the changing attitudes in America? You said initially he was a segregationist and he was very opposed to Martin Luther King Jr. Did he change at all?
He did. And he, again, would just say, I was wrong on segregation. I was reading the Bible incorrectly. One of the things I found very curious is that he never, although he would speak quite passionately about episodes in his childhood where he would look back and say, I can't believe that I and my whole culture were able to treat black people in such a degrading way. But he never looked at the way segregation actually was degrading to whites. That you know, the moral danger in a situation of oppression is not that you'll be a victim. The moral danger is that you'll be a bystander or a collaborator. And he never examined what white participation in Jim Crow meant for him and others like him.
In the black church, a lot of people were happy to see Martin Luther King Jr. Assume leadership because he was so brilliant at it. What about Jerry Falwell? Of all the people possible, was he tapped by other religious leaders to lead this political organization?
I think a couple of things, most having to do with his personality. There were television evangelists who had larger audiences, but he was a great organizer. He was great on the stumps. He was indefatigable. I mean, he just had this raw energy and just could keep going and going and going. His ministry bought him a plane so that he could fly around. And I think that is what he brought by way of example and its political effect. The Moral Majority only existed for 10 years, 79 to 89. And in those 10 years, the Republicans won three straight elections.
Was that their stated goal for Republicans to win elections? Because they were Republicans they must have not agreed with. At that time anyway, the Republican Party was a big tent.
Well, yeah, it is ironic that when the Moral Majority was founded here in New York, the senior senator was Jacob Javits. But Falwell clearly wanted not only to get Republicans into the White House and Congress, but he wanted to make the Republican Party more white, more Southern, more conservative, and more Christian than it had been, which is curious because obviously demographically the country is becoming less white, less Southern, less conservative, and less Christian.
How did he deal with the fact that Jimmy Carter was an evangelical?
He felt great betrayal. I mean, this was a real problem. And one of the immediate events that catapulted evangelicals into getting politically involved was in 1978, the Carter administration, the IRS changed the rules by which Southern Christian academies proved that they were in compliance with anti-discrimination laws. And the blowback from that was enormous because this was not just a debate about government policy. This was the government intruding into the Christian churches and their schools, very similar to what we just saw with the Obama administration and the Catholic Church on this whole HHS mandate contraception controversy.
So they felt that Bob Jones University could discriminate against blacks because it was a religious institution. What about his college, Liberty?
Yeah, he himself had already actually desegregated his own schools, and Liberty was always desegregated from its first moments. But he and Bob Jones always had very bad blood. Bob Jones in 1980 described Jerry Falwell as the most dangerous man in America precisely because of this political involvement. And Jones felt that, you had to stay separate from the world because it was just filled with sin and it would take you down with it.
The Moral Majority threw its support behind Ronald Reagan in the 1980 election. Reagan wasn't a church-going man. He had even helped legalize abortion in California when he was governor. So what attracted Falwell to Reagan? Just that he wasn't Jimmy Carter?
And the kind of conservatism, the American exceptionalism. But also, they could be very – evangelicals can be very forgiving so long as sins are repented. And by 1980, Ronald Reagan had repented publicly for signing the liberal abortion law. It is curious, he was also the first divorced president. And gave off in his personal life this sense of tolerance that, was allergic to Falwell. And I think in that sense, today's Republican Party actually is much more properly seen as Falwell's legacy than as Reagan's.
Falwell credited himself and the Moral Majority for Reagan's success in the election. Was he exaggerating his influence?
There's some debate, but the pollster Lou Harris said Reagan would have lost by one percentage point had it not been for the 46 million evangelicals that Jerry Falwell had registered. Certainly, I think Reagan would have won the South. But what we're realizing is that the real decisive evangelical vote is in Southwest Michigan, Northwest Ohio, in the Midwest, in Missouri. That's where you see, in these swing states that you have large numbers of evangelicals.
Was Falwell able to actually play a role in the Reagan administration? Did he get some of his people into positions in the White House?
He stayed a little bit hands-off. He would fight with some of the Michael Deaver in the first spring of the administration, said that the evangelicals were welcome but they had to come in the back door, and which Falwell responded that Mike Deaver couldn't spell abortion. Reagan was always very forthcoming. George H.W. Bush was even more solicitous, went down to Lynchburg and gave a commencement address at graduation at Falwell's University. He was quite comfortable and pretty politically savvy. When Reagan said, look, we have to lead with the economic issues, not with the social and moral issues, Falwell supported that. When Reagan announced Sandra Day O'Connor's appointment, he called Falwell that morning before the announcement to let him know. And Falwell, unlike some other evangelicals who opposed it, Falwell refused to oppose it actively.
Now, why did the moral majority disband?
He really, at that point, wanted to pay more attention to the university and felt that the moral majority had accomplished its goals. It was an enormously taxing time and took up a lot of money, a lot of energy, and it actually never raised a lot of money. His ministries would be raising $100 million, and moral majority never had a budget more than $12 million.
So was it just replaced by the Christian Coalition?
It was. The Christian Coalition grew up out of really the Pat Robertson campaign in 1988.
And Ralph Reed, who had worked for Pat Robertson.
But to give you an idea of Falwell's gifts as an organizer and somebody who could really, you know, get the base going, the Republicans lose the next three elections after the moral majority disbands.
But
I count 2000 as a loss because Gore got more votes than Bush, but, you know.
But there were all sorts of other things. They became much more involved in government. We have the situation with Ralph Reed and Jack Abramoff worked together on political issues, even right. though Reed is supposedly working as a Christian and not a politician. The line started blurring at this point. Did it start blurring because of what Jerry Falwell had done?
I think so. I think, you know, he was somewhat politically savvy. It doesn't mean everybody else who was in the moral majority was politically savvy. And, you know, the line between church and state and more importantly, between religion and politics in our culture has always been contentious and always will be contentious. And some people don't know how to massage that line very effectively.
The Tea Party people, leaders anyway, claim that religion plays little role in what they're about. Do you see some kind of a link between Falwell and the creation of the Tea Parties?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you look at the polling data over the last year, you find that the real base of the Republican Party are people who are both Christian evangelicals and Tea Party members. And again, this is where Falwell's ability to ground, you know, profoundly anti-Christian thinkers like Hayek and von Mises and Rand and this libertarian economic approach in a kind of narrative that's biblically based, this is one of his key contributions.
Before the Florida primaries, Mitt Romney hired Brett O'Donnell, the debate coach from Falwell's Liberty University, and a New York Times article credited O'Donnell with Romney's surge. Is this evident of Jerry Falwell's continued influence on politics?
Oh, absolutely. Tony Perkins is an alumnus of Liberty University. Shannon Bream from Fox is an alumnus of the university. And their debate school was something that Falwell was very proud of. But you see it also, the very first lawsuit filed against the Affordable Care Act was filed by Liberty University. Liberty Counsel, which is kind of the activist wing of their law school, which was founded in 2004, has been very active in litigation surrounding church-state issues.
It's impossible to know how Jerry Falwell would have reacted to the current Republican primary situation, but it does surprise a lot of people that Rick Santorum, who is a Catholic, has captured so much of the evangelical vote, considering the fact that earlier in American history, Catholics were called papists, and
right.
And John F. Kennedy had to make that speech that Santorum has since said made him want to throw up.
Right. Falwell, in before forming the moral majority, Baptists had a belief that you could not be yoked with nonbelievers. And by nonbelievers, they meant Catholics and Mormons and everyone who was not a fundamentalist Christian. And under the influence of Francis Schaeffer, who was another leading intellectual of the evangelical cause, he developed the theory of co-belligerency, which was citing the example of Simon the Cyrene helping Jesus carry his cross. It was fine for true believers to yoke themselves on behalf of moral concerns with non-believers.
And we've seen some of that in the way foreign policy in the Middle East has been approached.
Yeah, and this is what, curiously, his first break with the Reagan administration in the first 6 months. He went along with the idea that they were going to lead with economics, went along with Sandra Day O'Connor. The one area he broke was on AWACS sales to the Saudis. That Falwell, and I would give Falwell some credit for this, which is anti-Semitism, which was quite rampant in the evangelical community before, is not there now. And he helped stamp that out.
Some of Falwell's harshest criticism came from inside the Christian community and the National Council of Churches, whose president compared Falwell to the Ayatollah Khomeini. Why do you think he provoked such strong feelings?
There's a variety of reasons. First of all, he intended to provoke those feelings. He understood. He liked the fight. He was very competitive. Secondly, I think he brought a brand of Christianity that people had grown unfamiliar with. In the post-war era, the face of Christianity in this culture was Niebuhr and Dr. King and the Berrigan brothers and Father Drinan, the Jesuit member of Congress from Massachusetts. And along comes Falwell, and in the course of the 1980s, the face of Christianity becomes white evangelical preachers like himself. And to a degree, there is still that. So obviously a more mainstream and liberal group like the National Council of Churches resented not just his political positions, but the fact that he was quite effectively presenting a very different face of Christianity to the culture.
But so many things, Jerry Falwell was fluid in his relations with Larry Flynt.
One of the most bizarre things, you know, he has this famous lawsuit with Flynt over a ad parody that Flynt had run in Hustler magazine attacking Falwell and suggesting he had had incest with his wife, with his mother in an outhouse. That was how he had lost his virginity. And this court case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. But of course, you know, in the course of that, and then they do a dog and pony show where they're going to colleges to debate and this kind of thing. Well, they both had their private planes, and they at one point realize this is ridiculous. So one of them offers a ride to the other. And from that time, a friendship developed, and every time Jerry Falwell was in Los Angeles, he would always visit Larry Flynt.
And on the Larry King show that they did together, they hugged.
Oh, yeah. It was a true friendship. Larry Flynt, to this day, will say, you know, I agreed with him on nothing, but he was my friend.
Well, and would Falwell have said the same thing?
Absolutely. But he would always say, I want to be there when he's ready to come to Jesus. I mean, there was a real ambition that Falwell had to save Larry's soul.
So what's the current situation in Lynchburg, the university, Liberty University? Is that a school that a lot of people want to attend?
It is the largest evangelical university in the world. It is very successful. As I mentioned, their law school was started in 2004, got accreditation in the shortest time you can get accreditation. It's run by Jerry Jr.
And they win a lot of debates, I gather.
A lot of debates. They have good sports teams. It is a different school. It's somewhat different from Falwell State. They've relaxed some of the rules about what women can wear on campus and the length of boys' hair and things like that. But it's still quite a traditional evangelical school.
And what about his son? Is his son, Jerry Jr., as involved in politics as his father was?
Much lower profile. And Jerry Jr. runs the university. His other son, Jonathan, runs the church and is the pastor of Thomas Road Baptist Church. And both of them are much more low-key profile political actors than their dad.
Well, considering the fact that fundamentalists are right now deeply involved in American politics and we hear the language of fundamentalism in so much of the political debate today. There are two things here. One, Jerry Falwell kind of withdrew, and his sons have withdrawn, and yet at the same time, if anything, their legacy grows.
Exactly. I mean, I would argue that Falwell succeeded. I mean, he made the Republican Party over in his image, and they address now not just issues of personal morality like abortion in these kind of absolute fundamentalist terms, but all issues from taxes to foreign policy. You have to stick to the party line.
But there are many religious Democrats. How did he deal with that? Did he say that they weren't really true believers?
He would say that they misunderstood the Bible and that their understanding of Christianity was wrong. It was flawed by modernism and faulty interpretation, that they didn't believe in biblical inerrancy the way he did. But he would also, you know, was not above saying, oh, they're just socialists and communists. I mean, the attacks on the president, President Obama's health care plan, are identical to what Falwell said about Hillary Clinton's effort to reform health care in the early 90s.
When did he die?
He died in 2007 from a heart attack.
Michael Sean Winter's book, God's Right Hand, How Jerry Falwell Made God a Republican and Baptized the American Right, is published by Harper One. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.